tonight we have Aubrey, who's going to talk about Churchill's hero or villain for 20-25 minutes, and then we're going to open up as usual to a discussion. So welcome, Aubrey.
I hope you all took note of that. You see, SWP, you get 25 minutes. If this was a war crimes tribunal, I'd have 25 years. So I hope you've come for the long haul. Yeah, joking aside, as I go through this, you'll probably find there's a lot of contemporary and current issues around Syria and Iraq, and not some very thing that's not for long, but people are being charged with war crimes. Yeah, Churchill got away with it. Marx stated that the prevailing ideas in society are the ideas of the ruling class. This is probably no more evident than in the myth, that surround the legend of Britain's supposed great war hero, Winston Churchill. It was Winston what did it, it is often claimed, of how he virtually, single-handedly pulled this tiny, defenceless, unprepared little island to stand alone against the might of the heavily armoured Nazi blitzkrieg that had trampled the rest of Europe. Our task is to unravel these myths and expose the truth about Churchill. It is true he was a champion of his class and their interest. But their interests are not our interests, the interests of the working class. When they glorify Churchill and his role, remember they are engaging in ruling class propaganda. Propaganda that diverts us from pursuing the interests of the working class and subjugate them to the to British nationalism, a nationalism which serves the interests of the ruling class. Okay, there's a lot of thing about what where Churchill's politics was. Was Churchill a conservative, a liberal, a maverick, or just simply a Tory bastard? When we talk about fascism, we are very careful to be accurate and distinguish fascism from other versions of right-wing politics, even when those right-wing politicians revert to out-and-out thuggery, a not uncommon practice, as some of you will have experienced. Fascism comes about with the clear aim of smashing working-class organisation. It is more accurate to describe Churchill as the last of the great Whig aristocrats. To understand Churchill and his role in 20th century history, we need to understand his ideology, the ideology of Whig imperialism. When working class kids went to school, the boys, some of you might not remember this, but some will. When working class kids went to school, the boys were taught woodwork and the girls domestic science. At Harrow, Churchill and his compatriots were taught about ancient Greece, about Sparta and Athens. All were being prepared for their perceived role in society. Churchill wasn't just being taught about Greek superheroes, he was being taught about different models of governance. The top-down kingship of Sparta, in contrast to the democratic system of Athens. But this wasn't democracy in the way we mean, democracy which involves the masses. No, it's a democracy limited to a forum, via which the property classes sort their affairs and pursue their interests. European history is littered with conflicts between advocates, or maybe I should have said adversaries, of these differing models of governance. But his advocacy, based on the position of the competing advocates, usually different sections of the ruling classes, and their relationship to the centre of power, the Roman Senate versus their emperor, the Saxon Witan, usurped by the Norman Conquest. The British ruling class will often seek to portray past conflicts through Whig perspective of free Englishmen, the yeomen of England versus the suppressed French. The First World War is often portrayed liberal England versus totalitarian Germany. Churchill would no doubt be inculcated into this perspective of history, especially as his ancestor, John Churchill, is portrayed as an hero of this movement. When they are the ones exercising power and reaping the rewards, they are pro-top-down authoritarianism. If the source of power, usually a monarch, threatens their status, privileges, then they want to rein in the source of power and want to subject them to laws, such as Magna Carta, so-called democratic institutions, senates, parliaments, and other restraints, such as collective cabinet responsibility. If the threat is external, such as a foreign power, they are tyrants who threaten our freedom. The politics of differing factions of the ruling class fluctuate according to their relationship to the source of power. But whatever their position, politics, attitudes to authority versus liberalism, their position, status and wealth were all based on the exploitation of labour, whether it be slavery, serfs or workers. Whatever conflicts of interest they have between themselves, they will always close ranks to deal with any threat to that power, status and wealth. Democracy, liberalism, rights and freedom count for nothing when the ruling class feels threatened. For me, the gem of Marxism has always been, and I quote, the only freedom for the working class is the freedom to sell their labour. That is the only freedom that Churchill would guarantee. Gramsci argued that the ruling classes maintain their rule by a combination of coercion and force. When coercion fails, they have no compulsion about using whatever force they deem necessary. Churchill's biography bears testimony to this. According to Boris Johnson, one of our current favourites, who published a biography of Churchill, Churchill was the best for work rate, for rhetorical skills, for humour, for insight, for technical originality, and sheer blind bravery. Tories argue that through sheer power of his speeches, he inspired the people of Britain to rise up against the fascist threat during the Second World War. This lies in stark contrast to the opinions of those that knew him at the time. He was despised by his compatriots, particularly Baldwin and Chamberlain, his immediate predecessors as prime ministers. The revolutionary C.L.R. James noted that Churchill's own view of himself was that he is the only authentic great man of the world bourgeoisie. In truth, Winston Churchill had established himself as the most discredited, the most untrustworthy, and the most irresponsible of all senior politicians in England. The rulers of Britain did not take him seriously on the politics of war because they did not take him seriously on anything except his capacity to make a serious nuisance of himself. They despised him. He was really out. He first came to public prominence when he wrote about his experience as an escapee from the Boers in South Africa. Well, most of you will have seen the film, The Young Churchill. He made his name on the back of this self-promoting and other subsequent war journalism, boosted his bank balance, which helped to pay for his extravagant lifestyle, and launched himself into Parliament as MP for Oldham. During World War One, unlike the millions of ordinary soldiers, he didn't exactly rough it. Everywhere he went, a long bath and a boiler for hot water for heating the bath water was dragged along after him. He and his fellow officers ate oysters and drank champagne. Amidst the carnage of the trenches, he wrote to his wife, "I love this war. I know it's smashing, shattering the lives of thousands every moment, and yet I can't help it. I enjoy every second of it." In 1918, he wrote from the Ritz Hotel, "I am trying also to arrange to give the Germans a good first dose of the mustard gas before the end of the month. Their whining in defeat is very gratifying to hear." The warmonger. He was obsessed with finding quick solutions that would topple the enemy. This gained him his well-earned reputation for recklessness. The Dardanelles expedition in 1915 was the most notorious of these, where he oversaw pointless slaughter in Gallipoli. He had no compulsion about the loss of thousands of lives. Well, again, lots of you will have seen a film, I forgot what the name of the film is called, it's about war correspondence at Gallipoli. And the film shows how he and his wife Clementine were more concerned about his reputation and political career than the lives of thousands of troops based at Gallipoli. He displayed similar recklessness when he sent ill-prepared troops on a failed mission to Norway in the months prior to becoming Premier. A strategy which filled his peers with trepidation as to his suitability as a wartime premier. The Dieppe raid was another Churchill-inspired folly which led to reckless loss of life. To him, the lives of ordinary people were easily expendable. Ordinary people are only here to serve the interests of their rulers. We should be content to bask in their glory. Now, contrary to perceived in normal perception, Churchill was not an anti-fascist. He was a staunch defender of his class and expressed admiration for fascist leaders. Speaking to Italian fascist dictator Benito Mussolini in Rome in 1927, he said, "Your movement has rendered a service to the whole world. It has smashed the working class organisation and the Communist Party in Italy. If I had been an Italian, I should have been wholeheartedly with you from start to finish in your triumphant struggle against the bestial passions of Leninism." Mussolini was highly admired by the ruling class as a saviour of capitalism. Churchill wrote that Hitler had a perfect right to be a patriotic German if he chose. He also wanted England, Germany and France to be friends so they could carve up the globe between themselves. Prior to the war, the early years of the Second World War, overall the British ruling class was extremely reluctant to fight the fascists. Firstly, because the fascists were doing their dirty work of smashing working class organisation on the perceived but very real threat of communist revolution. And secondly, memories of the First World War were still fresh in their minds. Not the carnage of the trenches, but that Britain had been brought to the brink of bankruptcy. Several other long-standing empires had collapsed, and Britain also came close revolution in the years following the end of World War One. They feared that another war would be the end of Britain and the Empire as they knew it. Trotsky was optimistic that they were right. He believed that capitalism wouldn't survive another war. But, as stated earlier, Churchill was a Whig imperialist and feared the end of British global dominance and subservience to Germany. Better to sell bits of the Empire to the Americans, which was effectively what happened with Lend-Lease, where they sold off some of the islands in the British Empire to get ships and equipment from the Americans, and became the junior partner in global dominance. It's a common situation. Churchill was a skillful representative of the interests of his class, and he led the battle inside the ruling class to enter the war to defend such interests. He continued in that role after the war. Famously, he said, "I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears and sweat." Not his, of course, but the myth was born. Whilst he is portrayed as rallying the country in its darkest hour, on the brink of defeat and under the threat of invasion, the reality was different. It was this fighter for freedom, supposedly. He argued that a revolutionary situation was developing in the country. He wanted the suspension of Parliament, the introduction of martial law, and the formation of a committee of public safety armed with dictatorial powers. Fortunately, wiser minds saw that getting the unions and the Labour Party on board in the national government would better hold back unrest. He didn't rushed to defend the White Cliffs of Dover. Instead, Churchill ordered the British forces in Egypt protect the Suez Canal and the imperial link with India. Meanwhile, Australian, New Zealand and Indian forces were ordered to the Middle East, exposing those countries to a Japanese attack. And whilst Indian troops were defending the Empire, British troops were sent to India to suppress those calling for Indian independence. As late as 1944, Churchill resisted the Allied assault on France in favour of concentrating on the Mediterranean. Throughout the war, the radicalism of the resistance movements, which were mainly communist, proved a real threat to those at the top. This is why Churchill made manoeuvres to undermine the resistance movements which emerged. He sent British troops to Greece in 1944, after the resistance had already liberated the country, only to rearm the fascist militias the Germans had created, and with the aid of those troops, the British troops had sent to Greece and smash the communist resistance. There was a fear that if Greece fell to the communists, then Italy would follow, then after Italy, France, i.e. the domino effect. Although there was no love lost between Churchill and de Gaulle, Churchill manoeuvred to ensure it was de Gaulle who gained power in France after liberation, not the communist who had led the resistance. During the Bengal famine in 1943, it is now estimated that over 5 million people died, Famine was a product of the war. Imports of food grains from Burma were cut off by the Japanese occupation, and as a result, the price of food rose sharply. It was grain stored in India, but this was not released to the people. The poor could not afford to feed themselves and began to starve. Churchill was fully aware of the situation and refused to send emergency famine relief. Instead, he said Indians were used to starving. He said, "I hate Indians. They are a beastly people with a beastly religion. And also the Hindus are a foul race, protected by their mere pullulation." I'm not sure I pronounced that right, but pullulation, it means fast breeding. "From their doom, that is their doom." But that didn't stop him from opposing Indian independence. He wanted to retain the jewel in the crown of the British Empire. He opposed Indian independence after the Second World War. In 1951, the Egyptian government demanded the British evacuate and end its occupation of the country. The then Labour government responded with force, putting more troops in the country in an attempt to intimidate the Egyptians. But it was when Churchill was re-elected in the same year, the repression escalated significantly. Troop levels rose to some 80,000, and a brutal policy on Egyptian guerrilla attacks was authorised. A month after his election, a British commander ordered a village to be almost completely levelled because it was being used by snipers to harass the Suez water filtration plant. It goes into similar events nowadays. Such actions against forces which threatened Britain's imperial interests were not new to Churchill. In 1920, he ordered the RAF to use poison gas against the Kurdish rebels in northern Iraq. He said, "I do not understand this squeamishness about the use of gas. I am strongly in favour of using poison gas against uncivilised tribes." This was the first use of chemical weapons in Iraq. As I said at the beginning, you can see connections between Churchill's history and some of the things that's happening nowadays. At the same time he was ordering rebels to be gassed in Iraq, he was playing a key role in the war that was being waged on Irish people fighting against British rule. He was Secretary of State for War when Britain formed paramilitary Black and Tans and the auxiliaries in Ireland. This was to strengthen the role of the police against Republicans. The Tans and auxiliaries became a byword for brutality, for rape and murder. They rampaged across the country, carrying out reprisals against insurrection. But Churchill described them as honourable and gallant officers. He took the officer in charge of those murder gangs, a Major General Henry Tudor, to meet Prime Minister Lloyd George, saying he would stick with him through thick and thin. Just as Churchill fought fiercely against those who threatened his class internationally, he waged a war at home against the working class in Britain. In 1911, transport workers, including dockers, seamen, railway and tram workers, walked out on a strike for better pay conditions and for union recognition. Their action sent shockwaves throughout the ruling class. Churchill said, "Accounts from Liverpool show that the situation there is more like revolution than a strike." In response, he sent an unprecedented military enforcement to help rail bosses. A gunboat, HMS Antrim, was positioned in the River Mersey. More than 50,000 troops were mobilised across the country. They opened fire on civilians in Liverpool. I can't imagine it today, but this happened, and no doubt could happen in the future. Two workers, John Sutcliffe and Michael Prendergast, were killed. 5 days later, two more civilians were shot in Manelli. A year earlier, Churchill sent troops to threaten striking miners in Tom Paddy in Wales. The government acted to bury what had happened. No inquiry was called, and Parliament was adjourned to halt any awkward questions arising. Much of the brutality meted out to the suffragettes, some of us will have recently witnessed on television, accorded with his enthusiastic approval as Home Secretary. Occurred with his enthusiastic approval as Home Secretary. During the police siege of Sydney Street, he ordered firefighters not to put out a fire in a building with anarchists inside. He said it was better to let them burn to death rather than risk the lives of firefighters. They died, but he got headlines. He also became fascinated by eugenics and seriously urge the sterilisation of the unfit. That's what he knew to us. It's this sort of myth that he was quite popular. Early on in the war, he visited the East End during the Blitz, supposedly to raise morale. As he stood amongst the rubble, he said, "We can take it," to which the crowd, who were trying to salvage what remains of their possessions they could, cheered, "It's not you that's bloody well taking it." A real example of his popularity amongst working people can be seen when he came to address East Londoners at Walthamstow Stadium in 1945. He was jeered by 20,000 people, and he went to Ladbroke Grove in West London in the same year. He was pelted with stones. But the real test of his popularity came in the election of 1945, and under Churchill's leadership, and as a reward for that leadership during the war, the Conservatives were expecting a landslide. Well, yes, there was a landslide, one of the largest seen in British electoral history, for the Labour Party. Whatever his perceived war credentials, whatever the propaganda, the British public knew he couldn't be trusted to deliver the better society for which they sacrificed so much.